This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In June, General Electric confirmed it's considering a move out of Connecticut. The news came amid a state budget battle over corporate tax hikes. In an email to employees, CEO Jeff Immelt said GE would consider moving to what he called a more pro-business environment. The company's been courted by states like New York, Georgia, and Texas. Governor Malloy is trying to keep the company here. Meanwhile, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough was responding to news that GE might leave the state.
A few points on my home state of Connecticut. It's one of only four states that lost population last year. It was last in job creation last year. It's been dead last in job creation since 2008. And time again, it's been selected as one of the least business-friendly states with the worst business tax policies.
Yeah, that's Joe Scarborough from MSNBC. Today, Where We Live, conversation with Catherine Smith, Commissioner of the Department of Economic and Community Development. We'll talk about GE, about jobs numbers, about incentives to keep companies here, and about travel, tourism, the arts, all things that are under her purview. I'll also fact-check Mr. Scarborough. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live, and also on CTN, the Connecticut Network. They have their cameras here today for our program. Joining us in studio, Catherine Smith, Commissioner of the DECD. Welcome back to our program. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be with you, John.
Also with us is Harriet Jones. Harriet is our business editor. Thanks for coming in, Harriet, to be my buddy today to ask some business questions.
Oh, you're more than welcome, John.
So first of all, let's just start with General Electric. When we hear from GE that it's looking for other places to go, including states with what they call a more pro-business environment, first of all, what does that signal to you, and what is your department doing about it?
Well, first, I mean, our goal is to create the best business environment here in the state that we possibly can, and I think we're well on our way towards doing that, although there is still work to be done, no doubt about it. And so, obviously, every company that's here in the state, you know, it's our goal to keep them here, have them grow their jobs here versus some other location. And so, obviously, we take this signal from GE very, very seriously, as we would any company of its size and stature, or even any small company that's located here. It's our goal to really make sure that we're addressing the issues that they have, making sure they recognize and understand some of the strengths that the state currently has that sometimes, honestly, people forget about who live here, which we can talk about as well. But there are a number of areas where Connecticut has huge advantage for companies like GE, and we want to make sure that GE and other companies of their ilk and, as I said, all size companies understand that.
What are some of the issues that you're hearing from them that they're putting on the table? I'm sure that these are the same issues that you hear from other companies about what makes a poor business climate in Connecticut.
Well, you know, GE has really not been overly articulate about on any other issues publicly other than the tax issues. But what we find is people are concerned about the business climate in a very fuzzy kind of a way. What does that mean to individual companies? It's one of the things we have been exploring over the last several months. We're working right now, listening again to companies to find out what is it that's on their mind. I think I would boil it down to a couple of areas. One is companies like certainty in the environment in which they're working. Surprises that come out at the last minute during a legislative session related to taxes or anything else for that matter are very problematic for companies. They want to know that the environment that they're operating in is going to stay roughly the same so that they can manage their business appropriately.
Harriet, and I just wanted to ask you about this because you cover this all the time, and we hear people like Joe Scarborough or people from all over the state saying something about our business climate and what exactly that means. Catherine Smith pointed to one thing that we've talked about an awful lot. Companies want certainty. Does it mean something other than that to you from what you hear?
Well, I was struck in this and how much, and I wanted to ask you about this, Commissioner, how much GE turned this into a piece of theater almost, because many companies, if they're going to look to relocate, will do it quietly. They'll go about, you know, kind of talking to other states, looking at other sites. They might not necessarily make this kind of high-profile announcement that GE made. It was really very, very striking that they did this during the legislative session. So I wondered if you had a sense of you know, what they were hoping to achieve by doing this in a very public fashion.
I agree with you. It's really unprecedented and not the normal way businesses go. But having said that, you know, they're a publicly traded company, and I think sometimes when companies go into a process of looking for a new headquarters for whatever reasons, you know, it is valuable to them to make clear to – rather than rather than have it leak out, have it become something that they're, you know, making the statements about. But frankly, I'm not certain why in this case they chose to make it a public effort.
Well, and it gets to something I think we've talked about a lot on our program, and I know, Harriet, you've covered a bit, which is that there seems to be a sense, especially from big employers in our state, and by the way, it's not just in our state, it's everywhere in America now. If a company thinks that the tax situation does not advantage them, or that they'd like to have the state do something that the state does not want to do, what they say is very publicly, we're going to move if you don't give us whatever. And I think that what's happening in our state over the course of the last couple of years, and you and your department and the Malloy administration have frankly been criticized for some of this, of reacting to what these companies say. Now, nobody wants a General Electric to pick up and leave or any of the insurers to take a whole bunch of jobs elsewhere. But at the end of the day, I mean, what's the state supposed to do? If a company says, we don't like your tax policy anymore, we're going to get up and leave, I mean, what do you have to do?
Well, you know, I look at this with my finance background, which is we really look at the dollars and cents associated with each of these companies and what they bring to the state in terms of state revenue, jobs, the downstream jobs that would be created from the activity of their employees, et cetera. And we look at this really from a bottom line perspective. So we want to know what's our opportunity to have a company grow here. So we're willing to put incentives in front of a company, but the present value of which is more than made up by the expected future revenue from the state or from that employer in the state. And on a downside with a company like GE, which we've done very few of simply retention deals, we want to say, hey, if they leave, what's the hole that they're going to leave in the state and how do we make sure that we're covering that? So we're very disciplined and financially oriented when we're looking at putting together our incentive packages. And I think other states don't behave that way, to be honest with you. A lot of states have a formula. We're going to give you X number of dollars per job, or we're going to give you a free building, or we're going to give you taxes for no taxes for 10 years, things like that. We're really looking at how can we incent this company to make the right decision, stay in the state, make the investments here that will help our economy grow.
It also brings up the question, though, of how do companies decide on site selection? Because I know tax incentives are in there somewhere,
yes,
usually maybe in the top 10. But they're certainly not – it's not number one. That's not the decision that's made by a big company like GE of what kind of tax package can they get, especially not GE, who is –
I was going to say, they don't pay a whole lot of taxes right now anyway. I mean,
exactly.
if they start paying taxes, that'll be the first taxes they've paid to the state for a very long time.
Although I have to say, covering the story, I did get slapped a little bit by GE for saying they pay no local taxes. They tell me they pay $1 billion in local state and local taxes every year, but they won't tell me how much they pay to Connecticut.
I was going to say, I think that has something to do with their employees maybe paying. From what I understand, we've done some research on this, I think they pay the $250 that the pizza place down the street pays to be a business entity. But anyway, I'm sorry. We'd love to ask you a question here about this, about this, but we're just so fired up about this very thing.
But it, you know, there are many, many factors that a company like that will take into account. You know, where its employees want to live, maybe where its CEO wants to live, you know, the C-suite executives, where they, you know, where they feel is the best quality of life, whether they're downtown, whether they're in a suburban setting. What's your sense of what GE is looking for?
Well, you know, I think in general, and I have no insight into their specific needs, but I would say in general, companies look at a variety of different topics. There's probably 10 or 12 items on everybody's list, the top of which is usually talent. Where do we get the right people to fill our jobs at the right cost with the right level of productivity? And that is almost always number one. Number two is often transit-oriented. So how do people get in and out of our site? How can we get access to the markets that we need? So, you know, you are seeing increasingly companies wanting to be on a train line, on a bus line, really making it easy for their employees to get to work and also for their salespeople to be on the road and working with their customers. So I think those are always in the top two. And then there's a variety of factors below that. And somewhere in there are tax incentives, to your point, because certainly the cost of doing business is also a very important factor that many, many companies take a look at.
And, of course, we'll talk about a lot of the things that are under the purview of Catherine Smith that get into the quality of life. I mean, why a company would want to have its C-suite or its employees here has an awful lot to do with education, something not in your purview, but the arts and going to the beach and everything else that Connecticut may have to offer. We're talking with Catherine Smith from the DECD. Harry Jones, our business editor, is here as well. We'll take some of your calls throughout the course of the hour at 860-275-7266. I just want to go through a little bit on this GE deal because it could affect so many people. You talk about the talent piece of it. Of course, one thing that has happened with GE is they divest themselves of this financial services organization. It seems as though the talent pool that they might need here in Connecticut is slightly different than when they were doing that business very heavily some years ago. I mean, is that fair to say?
Well, certainly, yeah, I think so. But, you know, they still have a pretty big headquarter presence, and so they're looking for headquarter-like functions, people with good accounting and financial skills, communication skills, you know, the kinds of things that you look for at the corporate level. So, you know, either way you look at it, those are the same sort of similar skills that you might be looking at for GE Capital.
When it comes to what package is going to be put together, I mean, are you talking with GE specifically? Is Governor Malloy negotiating with them? Do we have any sort of a timeline on what's happening here next?
Well, we typically do not disclose or discuss any kind of individual conversations with companies, but I can rest assured, I would say, that we are working very aggressively with any company that's in a position of either growing or considering exiting the state or considering coming to the state.
So GE's headquarters obviously is a big – it would be a big blow to Connecticut's image to lose GE's corporate headquarters. But maybe even the bigger jobs impact might be what's happening to GE Capital. We touched on that. They have thousands of workers in Norwalk. What kind of work are you doing behind the scenes on as they sell off pieces of GE Capital, whether that work is going to stay in the state?
You know, again, our mission in life, not just for GE Capital, but for any company that we see as a potential opportunity for growth here or for staying in the state, we pretty aggressively start contacting the companies that we think have potential to be in the state, whether that be a purchaser of a piece of GE Capital or whether that be a merger for a health insurance organization, you name it. We are always very proactive about reaching out to those entities and trying to sit down and talk to them, talk about the strengths that they can achieve here in the state.
Of course, financial services is one big piece of it. I mean, GE is in so many business lines. A big one is building jet engines. I'm just reading from the Connecticut Post and Neil Vigdor today. He writes, as Connecticut ponders a future without General Electric, which has threatened to leave the state over its growing corporate tax bill, some say the rift between the Fortune 500 superpower and the state really started years ago in a battle over fighter jet engines. He writes, politicians on both sides of the aisle say GE still harbors resentment over a 2011 loss to in-state rival Pratt & Whitney, which got the contract to supply engines for the Pentagon's latest generation fighter jet, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. Do you think there's anything to what Neil's writing there?
Well, look, we have a number of the supply chain companies in the aerospace industry that are suppliers to GE Aviation. And so those companies continue to do great business with them. You know, I have no idea about the politics of something like that. All I can say is GE Aviation, Pratt & Whitney, the entire aerospace industry is growing very rapidly right now, and our supply chain companies are jumping with enthusiasm and jumping to keep up with the demand that's coming their way.
And those supply chain companies are something you've reported on for years, Harry. I think the notion is that if you make things in Connecticut, it's just those big corporate jobs, and if they go, you know, just those jobs go. But there are so many small companies making so many parts for GE, for United Technologies, for these other manufacturers. It's really something to consider, the downstream effects.
Absolutely. And those are also companies that do also bring up these issues over competitiveness, over tax structure, over uncertainty. Those are all companies who also say, you know, what GE is saying is also something that's impacting smaller companies about business competitiveness.
And I think that those companies in large measure right now are pretty happy with what the state has done, though, because the state has really stepped up and said, we recognize there's a huge opportunity for aerospace, given the demand mostly on the commercial side for new planes and new engines over the next 10, 20 years. And we've put in place a number of things from the Manufacturing Innovation Fund in particular, which has got programs now to help them with talent and incumbent worker training, apprenticeships, helping them with making the investments they need to make pre-revenue, if you will, on new equipment, on getting their workforce ready to go. And I think those companies right now are saying, wow, this state really wants us here. They're excited about it. You know, we've just gotten the designation from the federal government of being one of the investing and manufacturing communities partners, one of a dozen states, localities around the country to be designated as such. So we think that's a great sign, and we think manufacturing is definitely got huge potential going forward in the state.
A last thing on this before we take a break. I think one of the things that Neil's article brings up, though, is another one of the issues when it comes to how the state decides to spend money, or another way to put it, give out tax incentives to corporations. If you have two big companies that both employ a lot of people and are in the same business, it's pretty fair to say that if you help out one, you're going to want to help out the other. And we have that in the sports television field, ESPN and some of the corporations that are doing it down in Fairfield County, between UTC and between GE. Is this one of the problems that a state gets into when you have to react to a GE and you also had to react to United Technologies last year? Now, all of a sudden, everyone's kind of lining up to hold you hostage for bigger, better deals to stay.
Well, you know, I'm going to go back to what I said a few minutes ago, though. The way we construct these deals, if we do them at all, is we make sure that the bottom line to the state is protected. So we are going to get back either our cost of capital or better. And if the company doesn't produce what it says it's going to do, then there's penalties and clawbacks associated with it. And that's true for the UTC deal. It would be true for any of the large deals we've done with big companies, even the small deals, right? We count on these companies to deliver for us.
What sort of mechanisms do you have to keep track of that sort of thing? When a company is given incentives and says, you say you got to create or maintain 200 jobs here over the course of the next however many years for this much money, what mechanisms do you have in place to make sure that they're actually doing that?
I have a group in my team, a compliance group, and their job is to go out and do the surveys on the job creation. We also require from the companies audited financials that they've spent the money on the capital improvements that they said they would. So we're pretty darn careful in making sure that the work is done that the companies say they're going to do. And once they've completed that work in the time frame that's agreed to, they might get the forgiveness. But if they don't, then they don't get the forgiveness. We saw that with a company a couple of weeks ago that didn't get their forgiveness. They got close, but they didn't quite make it. So we're disciplined. I guess that's what I say, financially disciplined about making sure that the state's investments, because I think of these as investments, these incentives, that our investments do in fact pay back for our state population.
We're talking with Catherine Smith, who's Commissioner of the Department of Economic and Community Development in Connecticut. Harry Jones, our business editor, is also here. We've got a lot to talk about, including big mergers in the insurance industry, what that might mean for the state. We're going to be talking about tourism and the arts. And we want to hear from you. Are you a local business owner? What can you say about the business climate in the state? We try to figure out what a business climate is with the head of the DECD. That's on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Catherine Smith. She's the commissioner of the State Department of Economic and Community Development. There's a lot that the DECD does. Later on, we're going to be talking about arts and tourism, some of the stuff that is under their purview. We're still revolutionary, from what I understand.
Absolutely.
But beyond that, we're also talking about preserving and maintaining jobs in the state. We've been talking about General Electric and some of the things they've said about maybe moving out of state. Harry Jones, our business editor, is here as well. Let's quickly go through just a few things we wanted to ask you about. We were talking about GE and UTC, jet engines we make here. Who from Connecticut went to the Paris Air Show? We were interested in that.
Well, the governor went, which was the most important thing from my perspective. He was joined by myself and a couple of people on my team. And we, every year for the last several, have been to either Farnborough or the Paris Air Show. We take a small number of staff people, but we take a large number of companies with us. So this year we had 10 companies in our Connecticut booth, all of whom probably couldn't afford to go on their own, but had the opportunity to go to this amazing air show. I mean, there's 350,000 people that go to that show every day that it's up and running, and all of the companies from all over the globe come. So it's a terrific place with everybody in one spot to do business. And so this year, our 10 companies have already completed about $70 million of transactions, and there's more to come. So, and I'm not even counting the biggest one that got done, which was between two Connecticut companies that were there, Pratt & Whitney and EDAC. So we're very excited about this. We think it's a great opportunity for our aerospace companies, and we're really thrilled to be able to take them along with us.
I wonder if that is something, where, again, where you do continued follow-up, because often it's not that, you know, things get signed on the dotted line in Paris, but maybe it's a slow burn thing where they form a relationship and maybe something comes of it a couple of years down the line. So is that something where you, you know, keep on top of things?
We absolutely do. We come back from these shows that we go to, and we do two or three offshore a year, not just aerospace, but in green technologies, medical, things like that. And we bring back a long list of leads for the state and for the companies that we take with us. And so, yeah, stay tuned. We hope to have a couple of announcements out of the air show within the next couple of months.
You talked about a few things that companies always talk about wanting out of Connecticut. One was the talent here. Another one was transportation, actually. And thinking about the Paris Air Show and thinking about some of the other investments that the state and the governor is making in transportation infrastructure, I'm wondering how involved you and your department are in those conversations. So when we talk about the traffic snarls in Fairfield County, or the lack of the number of trains that commuters might want to get into New York or into Hartford or New Haven, how much are you involved in those conversations on a regular basis? Because it seems like the people who you're most concerned about are the ones who are going to care the most about getting that stuff done.
Well, you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons I'm thrilled about working with Governor Malloy is he has created a team at the senior level. So we're not isolated. We're not working in our stovepipes. We work as a team to solve problems. So I meet once a month minimum with Jim Redeker. I talk to him probably much more than that. You know, when we want input from businesses, he calls me and says, hey, can you get a group of businesses to come talk to us about what the priorities are for whatever it is, the Hartford interchange or whatever it might be. So we're very much partnering. And when I get feedback for them, I give it to them right away.
It's interesting. I had this feedback actually from John Filchek at the Northeastern Council of Governments this week. We were at a rail freight forum. And he was saying he wishes that the DECD, when they give incentives to, say, a Lowe's or one of these companies to put a big distribution center in, he says transportation, how they get the goods in and out of there, should be part of that discussion.
And it is, believe me. I mean, you know, I think to Amazon coming into Windsor as an example, we partnered very closely with DOT and DEEP to make sure that that site was done in an environmentally sensitive way, that we were thoughtful about the amount of new truck traffic that would be brought onto the highway. So we absolutely partner. There's actually a role in DECD called the Permit Ombudsman, and that person's whole entire job is to coordinate with the other agencies in the state to make sure that the process for a new development or a redevelopment goes extremely smoothly. So if it's, you know, I always say when I hear of examples where people don't know about that, you know, let me know, because we definitely want that to be the experience. We want it to feel like it's one and done in the state, not you have to go to 85 places to get progress made.
We're getting a tweet here from Urban Data on some of the things we're talking about. Walkable communities, they write, are limited here. New Haven is the only place that competes with booming city centers elsewhere. And I think that's part of it as well, actually creating urban places where many, many businesses can work. I mean, we've been talking off the bat a lot about the big businesses that have their own large headquarters. But, you know, the real heart of a city is a lot of small businesses, some big businesses, some nonprofits all coming together and making a kind of a mix. And that's really what you're supposed to have, right?
Right. Well, and the whole other side of economic development, besides just working with companies who do create most of the jobs, so we definitely want to pay attention to them. But the other part is to make sure that we have really livable communities, which Connecticut is very well known for, has a very high quality of life. But we know that some cities have had trouble retaining their population downtown, be that livable residential type people or whether that's the workforce. And so we've been working closely with local communities to try to make sure that's happening. You've seen us invest tens of millions of dollars in cleaning up brownfields to make those sites, which are often right downtown, right on our transit routes, to make those more accessible for development, to work with you know, a place like Hartford to add more housing downtown, to make sure we have people walking on the streets and working in the buildings so that the community feels better and retail comes back and all of those kinds of things.
You mentioned brownfields, though, and I think it gets into that transportation conversation. Is there an argument to be made that when the state spends any money giving direct support to companies, individual companies, that we're missing one of the big opportunities that government has, which is to invest in the infrastructure or perhaps the job creation potential of all companies? If you put more money into redeveloping brownfields for many companies as opposed to just giving some money to one company to retain jobs, isn't it or couldn't it be seen as a better investment of state dollars?
Well, we're doing both, I'd say. I mean, we've put $125 million into brownfields in the last 4 years to redevelop them. And again, we're very focused on transit-oriented development type sites. So that's very, very important to us. And that, just to give you a little comparison there, that's versus $195 million at the federal level across all states in the same time period. So, you know, we are definitely making a big investment in that. And you, of course, have heard about the governor's transportation initiative, which is a huge infrastructure effort that will look at not just, you know, the highways and the trains, but we'll be looking at walkways and bikeways and other transportation modes as well. So I think this governor has been extremely committed to making sure that those infrastructure investments actually do get made.
I want to get to a phone call here. A few people want to join us at 860-275-7266 with questions for Catherine Smith from the DECD. Harriet Jones, our business editor, is also here. Barry's in Rocky Hill. Hey there, Barry. Oh, Barry's gone. Barry wants to ask. He had to go to work. Barry says, what do you think of nonprofit businesses as an economic driver, and where do they fit into this entire matrix here?
So we are a believer that nonprofits are an extremely important part of the environment here. You know, our Small Business Express program, which we started 4 years ago, actually is available to not-for-profits, LLCs, all different types of legal entities, and it's a recognition, I think, that those organizations do create jobs. They're a very important part of the community. And, you know, you mentioned earlier the arts, the cultural side of DECD. One of my main goals has been to try to bring that knowledge about that whole part of our economy forward, because they are also not just important for the quality of life, but they're a big part of our economic engine as well. So we really, I think, understand and really appreciate the value that those kind of organizations can bring to the community.
What did we learn from the July jobs report?
Well, I think we learned that we're on a pretty good roll. You know, we may be, as Joe Scarborough said, slow in many ways of getting out of this recession. But I think we've now started to hit our stride in terms of job creation. In the last year, we're up to over 30,000 new jobs created. We're now at 97% of the private sector jobs regained that were lost in the Great Recession. So while we were a little slow getting off the bench, if you will, I think that's because not much had been done in the state for many, many years. And now we're starting to see the impact of the programs we've put in place, of the slow but sure rise in the economy. And so we're actually quite happy about the numbers that have come out recently.
Of course, Harriet, one of the things that always happens when we talk about whether it's taxes or anything else, it's how we're performing versus our nearest competitors. We're doing better, certainly, with our economy and with our jobs numbers, but not quite as well as, say, Rhode Island, not quite as well as Massachusetts.
Certainly. I think Massachusetts is now something like 130% of pre-recession levels, so they're doing a lot better than us. And I think also if you dig down into the Connecticut data, you see how uneven this recovery is. I mean, you know, somebody who lives in the southeast of the state, we lost jobs in that that July report. And, it, you know, there's certain pockets of the economy that really are things are still very tough.
I agree. And look, we are behind Massachusetts, but I'd say they came out of the block much faster. And I do think that our rate of growth, we were number four, I think, in the country in the first half of the year in terms of economic growth. So I think it's been slower to get going, but I do think now we've started to hit our stride. And so, you know, it is not perfect. As I said, we've got many, many things still to do, and there is unevenness and things that we're addressing in some of the communities that have had a harder time recovering. But I think overall, you know, we should be happy that we're starting to see the impacts of all the good work we're doing.
How much do you benchmark against other states? I mean, when you say Massachusetts came out of the blocks faster out of the recession, I mean, what were they doing right?
I think it's largely because they had an economic development activity in the state for many years before. And honestly, Connecticut, when Governor Malloy came on board, was pretty much asleep at the wheel around economic development. You know, we invented a few new programs like the First Five, like the Small Business Express, to try to step into a void. You know, we've stepped up in brownfield redevelopment. We're looking at infrastructure. We've invested enormously in education, all components of a really important economic development strategy that really weren't in place, 10 years ago. So we think these are all important elements that are going to help us catch up. But, you know, there are still many, many, many many, many miles to go before we can rest.
The commissioner just mentioned the Small Business Express program, Harriet, and the First Five program. I know that that's something that you've been tracking, something we wanted to ask her a little bit about.
Well, yeah, I am curious about Small Business Express. It's been refunded again, and you've had, you know, certainly a great level of success with those loans, but you've had some high-profile failures, too. We've seen some real headlines made, Earl O'Garrow, Smith Wiley, Back Nine. When you have something like that that hits the headlines where, you know, an investment has gone wrong, do you go back and look at your underwriting structures? Do you look at, you know, who it is you're lending money to and how you're doing it?
Yeah, of course. You know, we believe in Lean and Six Sigma inside of DECD, and so we continuously improve our processes. But I would say if you look at the overall portfolio, and we've now made loans to over 1,400 companies, just about 2% of them have been in trouble, have gone out of business. And frankly, that's a very low percentage if you looked at a typical bank small business portfolio. So it's still a young portfolio, so I'm not going to say that's where it's going to end because it could rise. But you have to expect when you make these loans that you're going to have some of them that don't work. We also have way more that are doing extremely well. And if we look at our job audit, which we do every year, we go out and ask all of those companies, you said you were going to create so many jobs. Did you actually do it? We're at 107% of the overall jobs. So, yes, some have gone out of business, but more than enough have made up for that so that we're not just at what we expected, we're slightly better than what we expected in job creation.
So, famously, Small Business Express doesn't question what type of business you are. You lend to all different types
yes.
of businesses. And you've had the criticism that really, you know, economic development and state dollars, taxpayer dollars, should be more going towards businesses that maybe have a high multiplier, where we're going to see additional jobs created around them, businesses that pay higher wages. Shouldn't we be targeting a bit more now?
Well, with the Small Business Express was really put in place as a Main Street kind of mainstream business support system. And that was why we did it, because we heard so much from so many businesses that couldn't get access to capital from their normal lenders. The rest of our programs, which are for the larger businesses that are intending to really grow, are much more targeted. We have six economic development sectors that we're very focused on, be it advanced manufacturing, bioscience, life sciences, financial services, and the components there, digital media, green technologies. These are areas where if you get above that Small Business Express, small company, we're really looking to be very targeted in where we put the funding. So, yes, we agree with you. We do need to be very specific about what we're doing, which isn't to say we're going to say no to just any old company, but we're very thoughtful about how we're expending those state dollars.
So as you mentioned, you put Small Business Express in at a time when access to capital was very, very difficult. That's changed now. You know, things are a lot easier. It's easier for a company to go out and get a plain old bank loan. Yeah. So do you still see a continuing need for it?
Well, it's definitely slowing, and the pipeline is slowing, and rightfully so. And we talk with all the potential applicants about what they're doing with their bank first, right? So what has your bank done for you? And oftentimes we're collaborating with banks as we make these loans, if we do make loans still. And also we're using the Small Business Express now to go after what I'm going to call those harder hit communities. So we're very much targeting the areas where unemployment is still quite high, and trying to make sure that we're servicing those businesses as best we can so that we can, you know, lift the boats in that particular market as much as we can possibly do.
To address what Harriet was talking about before, that when you look at state numbers, even a small state like this, there really are regional impacts that are being felt much more delicately in some places than others. Dan is in Middlebury. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to call up. I'm the owner of a small business. I have 9 employees. And I know that I'm kind of the minnow in the ocean, but I feel like I'm a pretty good representation of a large majority of the businesses. And I wanted to address the government's rules and regulations and the fact that I feel like there's not enough enforcement to enforce these regulations and rules that the above-board businesses follow, which do cost money, where they're competing against businesses that don't quite follow those, whether it be income tax, insurance requirements. I mean, for one example, I'm an arborist, and there's arborist law where I have to be an arborist to perform tree care. And, you know, it's regulated by the Department of Environmental Protection and Energy. And I've heard directly from them. They basically, yeah, I can turn in as many people I find operating without a license as I want, but they don't have the funds to actually pay for people to go around and do enforcement. I mean, that's just like one example of, you know, if you follow the rules, but the rules aren't being enforced, then it puts you in a worse competitive position against businesses that aren't.
Well, and above everything else, Danielle, you probably don't want to be spending your time going around finding people who are breaking the rules and reporting them. You got trees to cut, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have work to do, but, you know, it's basically if you're not able to compete with, you know, companies that are doing the job for less, then you unfortunately find yourself with a little more time on your hands where you have time to do things like that. So trying to change it from the inside, you know.
Hey, I really appreciate your phone call. Catherine Smith?
Well, look, Dan, I couldn't agree with you more that we definitely want to enforce the rules that are on the books. I mean, first thing we've tried to do is make sure the rules that are on the books are reasonable. We've been through a whole process to deregulate where we think we can and simplify. But when the rules are on the books, we definitely want to make sure that they're enforced. But we do face a very challenging budget situation in the state, and the governor's been very clear that he wants fiscal stability for the long term, that he wants a smaller government over time. In fact, under Governor Malloy, we've reduced the employment by about 2,400 individuals, which is about 4%. So, yeah, there are areas that get impacted, and it's hard to know exactly if you're a commissioner exactly where to put your focus. But I appreciate you raising this. I will definitely talk to the commissioner of DEEP about it.
We wanted to get to that small business voice, but before we move too far away from some of these things, we talked about Small Business Express, the First Five program, which is now the First 15, the First 20, the first
15.
How many? The first 15. And could you explain exactly the goals of that initiative and whether or not you believe those goals have been met?
So the goals of First Five were really to put Connecticut back on the map, particularly for larger companies. It was announced very early in the governor's first term, and it was a program designed for larger companies, companies that would grow 200 or more jobs and spend $25 million or more in capital expenditures as part of that growth. We've announced 13 of the 15 slots, and by the way, there were five to begin with, and then the legislature added 10 more slots. And those companies, you know, are a number of household names that have chosen Connecticut. The first was, of course, Cigna, who moved their headquarters back to Connecticut from Philadelphia, and they've promised to grow between 200 and 800 jobs. Of the 13 companies so far, I think we are extremely happy with the results. The companies have met or exceeded their goals. There are a couple of companies that are a little behind, one that came from Australia that it took them a little longer than expected to get a site here and get going, but their job creation has now started. So, but in total, these companies are performing. We've leveraged against our state dollars $1.3 billion of private sector capital in the state for that growth.
Harriet, I mean, we've been hearing from a lot of people about First Five, whether or not it's something that works. You've heard from economists and you've talked to a lot of people around the state, including small businesses that maybe feel like they wish that they had some of this investment coming their way. I mean, how do we look at First Five or First 15 this couple of years in?
Well, first of all, I'm wondering if GE is going to be number 14.
No comment.
I guess I sort of saw that no comment coming. How about we'll try another one? Cigna's one of them,
yeah.
And Anthem and Cigna, with the merger that's been announced, something we've talked about on the program, they're trying to figure out how to integrate. How does this play into to the First Five designation here for Cigna? At the end of the day, if Anthem decides that they're going to take some jobs out of state, what happens?
Well, again, we have a contract with Cigna, and it goes two ways, right? We provide them some funding to do this enormous investment they were making in their campus and the growth of employees. And in return, they agreed to stay in the state for 10 years. They agreed to make all the investments. They agreed to keep a certain number of employees here. So it's a contract. If they decide to move employees out of the state, you know, there will be penalties associated with that. So we think it's a good thing that we have that contract with Cigna as they're looking at this, because it gives them at least some basis for, you know, keeping a foothold here in the state.
Are you concerned about these two mergers, the two ones that affect Connecticut companies?
You know, mergers are always tricky. And having lived through a couple of them myself when I was in the private sector, you know, I know that the companies, when they're going through them, are very careful and thoughtful about the integration strategies that they pursue. I feel pretty optimistic about our chances, the Connecticut chances of holding on to these the vast majority of the employment in those two entities because of the really deep basis of talent that we have here. You know, the knowledge base of our insurance industry is not just resident inside these companies. It is the professional community around that, be that the lawyers, the accountants, the actuarial firms that sit here in Hartford. So I think our talent base is extremely strong, and the number of these companies have extremely deep roots here. So I'm optimistic that they're going to choose Connecticut, but we're going to work with them to try to make sure that they do that.
So I'm wondering how you see these two particular mergers, though. I mean, what I've heard is that Aetna, Humana, the types of business they have are quite different, whereas Cigna, Anthem, the business is fairly similar. So that could be the one where we see more job loss, perhaps we see more jobs moving. I'm wondering, you know, as somebody who came from the insurance department, insurance industry, how you see that?
Well, I think, yeah, each deal, you know, the integration process is again, mapped out based on the needs of the customer base, based on the existing footprints of these companies, et cetera. So it's really hard to predict exactly what will happen. But as I said, I think in large measure what people go through in evaluating that is, what is the talent base? Who do I want to keep? Where is the business focus? You know, so many of the jobs in insurance companies are customer facing because they have huge claims operations, they have call centers, they have a big sales force. The things that are customer facing, when you combine two organizations that don't have overlap in their membership, which most of these do not, really requires them to keep a lot of those jobs. And many of those jobs are the kinds of things we're doing in Connecticut. So I'm, like I said, I'm optimistic that we will fare well in this. But again, we don't want to leave it to chance. We're working with companies as much as we can to help them understand the strengths of Connecticut.
We're talking with Catherine Smith. She's the commissioner of the State Department of Economic and Community Development. When we come back, we're going to do a lightning round. A lot of questions still to get to, including questions having to do with travel and tourism and having to do with the arts. Yes, we're still revolutionary from what I understand. We're talking with Catherine Smith and Harriet Jones, who reports on business for WNPR. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll revisit our conversation about the 5-day work week. Is it the most efficient and effective way to get things done? What would happen if Americans worked 32 or 24-hour weeks instead? We'll take a closer look at the impact and practicality of shorter work schedules. It's a nice thing for a Friday in the summertime. That's our conversation tomorrow. Tomorrow afternoon, hope you can join me on Science Fridays. I sit in for Ira Flatow, and we'll be remembering the great Oliver Sacks. So hope you can join us for that. Harry Jones joins us. She's our business editor, along with Catherine Smith. She's the commissioner of the Department of Economic and Community Development. There's a lot to get to in just the last few minutes. So a lightning round starts with Joe in Hartford. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just want to ask opinion regarding, I don't know, the threshold between today's historically low corporate taxation rates, which have fallen from about 30% to far lower today, and the needs, and balancing that with the needs of the middle class and our greater societal needs as states continue to compete against one another in this race to the bottom by offering enormous tax breaks to wealthy corporations.
Joe, thanks for the question.
Well, look, you know, Joe, we couldn't agree more that we want to make every dollar work well for the state. That's why, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to call them investments, which are typically funded through our bonding operations. So they're long-term investments in these organizations really will pay back to the state. So you're going to get back not only the capital you put in, but more. But the tax situation is clearly something we need a tax structure in this state that aligns with our economic development goals. And we have some work to get there.
So you have a tax panel that's been meeting.
Yes.
To look precisely at that question, perhaps to reduce some of that uncertainty for businesses. What's going on with that?
Well, I'm not directly involved with that. It's being managed by Commissioner Kevin Sullivan. But I'm certainly on the wings talking about the very issue I just mentioned. How can we make sure that the kinds of areas that we're interested in investing in from an economic development perspective are being treated fairly and equitably from a tax perspective as well? And those balancing acts are challenging, particularly given sort of the systemic issues that our budget faces. But I think there's a path forward, and I think the governor is going to put that forward for us.
We got a tweet from New Indie Film. It says, why has the state dropped the tax credit for feature films?
Our tax credits for films have really shifted to be much more about people being resident in the state. So feature films that come in and do a 1 or 2 week stint of filming here in the state, yes, they have some economic activity that they generate in a very short period of time. But we're most interested in putting our dollars to work on companies that want to move here, build an infrastructure here, have all their employees working in the state, and that's why our tax credits now are focused on that.
Dan tweets at us, what does Commissioner Smith think about the Connecticut Gigabit Project?
I think gigabits are going to be a part of the infrastructure of the future, so we are definitely interested in making sure that companies have access to what they need. There's a variety of different ways that can be approached, and obviously we've got some of our cities looking at sort of taking a lead and getting it done into their communities.
You've also got a lot of corporations here that say, whoa, we don't want some sort of public internet here. We want to be at the table for this, and I'm sure they're talking to you about that.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, the state should not step in and do work that the private sector can do. I think from what we want to make sure is that we get access across the state and we get it at a reasonable price. So those are the kinds of dialogues that need to happen. But it's really important, I think, for us, particularly given the techie nature of the future, that we have that available to our companies.
For a long time, there was a Connecticut Commission on the Arts, which was really connected to the arts community. Obviously, that no longer exists. I mean, that got smushed in the DCD some time ago. What is your vision for how to keep the arts alive and thriving here? Because something I'll just quickly say, I know I said a lightning round, something we've said a lot on this program, though, before is when you make the arts just about economic development, then you essentially take one of the intrinsic things about the arts that makes it important to humans, and you essentially say that's not as important as making sure there's jobs here for it. So you're an economic development professional. How do you keep this balance and make the arts something that's actually part of Connecticut's fabric, not just a way to create jobs and economic growth?
Well, both have to be done. I totally agree. And we've taken a number of steps to try to do this. First of all, the Arts Commission may not exist in its former way, but we do have a whole cluster of people that advise us through our arts committee and our arts advisory council. And those folks are extremely influential in what we're doing in arts. And so we are very focused on that. Recently, I hired a new person to run our arts area, arts and culture both, Christina Newman Scott, who you'll have on the program sometime.
She's someone well-known to us. She's been on our program a number of times.
She's a direct report to me at this point because I feel so strongly that we need to reengage on the art side, that we're putting a special emphasis on it. So just as an example, we're about to announce our Good to Great program, which is helping arts organizations and tourist destinations really make those kinds of one-time investments that they need to make to go from good to great. So you're going to see more emphasis. And that, by the way, sure, it will help the economy, but even more importantly, they're really helping the arts organizations themselves.
One of the things I hear from arts organizations, and this is it's tough to deal with, but a lot of them had line items in the state budget, and they don't have line items anymore. And some of them still have line items, and the ones who don't have line items say, well, this isn't fair because I'm trying to compete for this very small amount of money. I mean, does the funding structure really substantially have to change of how we get money to the arts?
You said this was a lightning round, right?
Yes.
This is a longer than a lightning round answer, but I think we should change the structure. I think we've got some organizations benefiting from line items, a big chunk of our budget that we spend on arts. And by the way, we're very generous as a state on our arts for our arts organizations out of our state budget relative to other states. But we spend so much of it on a handful of arts organizations. So I think there does need to be a way to look for a more equitable and fair way to get money to more organizations.
We have 1 minute left. Do you have metrics that show that our Still Revolutionary tourism campaign has worked?
We do. We do a survey very regularly of the outcomes. We do. We look at, you know, the way in which hotels are being occupied. So occupancy in hotel, for example, is up 5.5% this year. Tourism has been probably one of the leaders in terms of job creation, which has been up about 3 to 4% a year. So, yeah, there's a number of metrics that we do follow and track to make sure that revolutionary brand tourism dollars are being well spent. We think it's more than covers the cost in terms of the generation of sales tax in the state.
And you were at a press conference yesterday, Harriet, in which the big news that came out of it at Mystic Aquarium was Governor Daniel Malloy and a beluga whale.
Yes, it was.
And it was a very nice thing. And there's
really,
a little tourism component there.
It was a very visual story for the radio.
It was indeed. You can go online to basically Twitter or Mashable or Time.com and find Harriet's pictures of this press conference at Mystic Aquarium. Boy, there's so much more to talk about with Catherine Smith, Commissioner of the Department of Economic and Community Development. We'll just have to have you back with the governor sometime. We can
Happy
talk more about
it.
This stuff.
Super.
Thank you so much for coming in. I also want to thank Harriet Jones, who's our business editor. Thank you so much, Harriet.
You're welcome.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown with help from Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Technical producer, Kyone Wolf. Heather Brandon's our digital editor. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Once again, join us for a rebroadcast of our program about a 4-day work week. I think it's a good idea. I'm actually going to be working, though, tomorrow in New York for Ira Flatow, working on Science Friday. Hopefully you you can join me for that as well. Thanks also to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.